my honourable friend, I'm very happy to wish him a very happy birthday today. Many happy returns. I hope that Mrs. Bone is going to treat the occasion in an appropriate manner and...
Order! I want to hear what's coming next!
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Right Dishonourable podcast. My name's Jimmy Nichols and I'm joined, as per usual, by my lovely co-host, Jazza John. Jazza, how are you?
I'm great. And as always, it makes me giggle that you managed to splurse out the exact same words every single week to introduce me. Well done. Very proud of you.
Well, you know, I am a professional, qualified journalist, so it's the sort of thing you learn in journalism school.
There's no need to be smug, is there? What, they taught you how to podcast in journalism school? Bugger off.
Let's not be silly. They don't understand the internet and technology and journalism. So
yeah, the internet needs to change for journalism, not the other way around.
Yes, that's very much the way I feel about it. Do you want to discuss some of the comments we got about last week's podcast, or should we save that to the end?
Well, I've always thought that the gay guy needs to shut up and let other people talk as well. And so those criticisms I was pretty open for.
Yeah. I mean, that has been a recurring problem throughout the podcast, I must admit.
I mean, it took for us to have... Like, we got very good ratings last week, didn't we? It was very exciting.
People were generally quite happy, but there was one user who actually posted our first review on iTunes that hasn't ordered
been five
us
stars.
Five stars. Have you read this?
No, I haven't read it yet. What did he say?
Okay. Actually, it actually kind of sounds like you wrote it, so I'll just run this past you. It's by a guy called Ante, an interesting young white male Southeast England take on politics. Not always well informed, particularly on issues outside of their experience, so they have listened to it, obviously.
Yeah, at least they've listened to it.
For example, their understanding of Scottish politics is non-existent, but reflects many of the attitudes that anger Scottish voters. They also fail to represent any female voice, no doubt because potential contributors have heard the podcast and its attitudes towards women. It's a bit harsh.
Yeah, but a bit harsh. We have had female guests on before.
However, it's good to be exposed to alternative views in my podcast feed, so...
Oh, wow. So this is something that I've quite worried. Like, Sargon of Akkad was a lovely, lovely guest, but I particularly disagree with him on an awful lot of things. I think we managed to have a civil discussion at the end of the day. But I do kind of worry that we've kind of been taking under the wing of quite a lot of the alt-right.
what do you mean by that?
Well, there was one guy on Twitter who said, well, they're the Right Dishonourable. They've already got right in the title. Induction into the alt-right confirmed. And I'm like, oh, dear.
Well, you know, if it generates views, then, you know, or listens.
And Jimmy, that's
fine by me.
I'm shocked and appalled by the fact that you are the one who's apparently chasing fame and fortune, Jimmy. Who the hell are you?
I guess hanging around with you as a YouTuber has rubbed off on me, finally.
Rude. So. You also put videos on the internet not too long ago, don't forget that.
That is true. Shall we go on to discuss what topics we're going to cover rather than read out all the abuse that we've had on Twitter from Sargon's visit?
Yeah, sure. So first of all, it's very exciting. You remember all of that Barney that's going down with the UK Independence Party, and Stephen Wolfe has now left the party officially after he was punched and knocked out outside of the European Parliament. Well, that
it
is still
does sound
going...
as though criminal charges could be filed in that thing.
Oh, so am I not? Are you now going to tell me that I'm not going to say allowed to say anything about it, Jimmy? Is that
well? The charges haven't been filed yet, and if they are filed, they'll be filed in Belgium. So I think we're okay.
Well, we are still technically part of the European Union. Does that count towards anything in terms of my safety as a person who wants to talk about shit?
I don't think so, but I'd have to check.
Oh, exciting.
But they haven't filed charges anyway, so, you know, run your mouth as much as you like.
So Stephen Wolfe has was running for the leadership of UKIP, and now that he's left the party, assumedly he's no longer running. So that left until very...
You never know with UKIP, though, right?
Yeah, you never do know. It's very exciting. That did just leave Raheem Kassam, who used to be the UK editor for Breitbart. Am I inflating his position at all there?
Is he? I thought he still was the...
Is he still?
Has he resigned? Surely he's not going to resign until he's confirmed as UKIP leader.
No, you don't want to put all of your eggs in one basket. So Raheem Kassam was the one guy running for this position up until today, which is Sunday, where we've seen Suzanne Evans throw her hat into the ring. She wasn't able to run the last time because she was under a 6-month suspension because she, complained about another person running for UKIP office or something. Apparently there's... Well, no, you've got to give UKIP one thing. They do have intra-party discipline down to a T. And then against Mr. Kassam and Ms. Evans, we also have Paul Nuttall, who is seen... who was the number two underneath Nigel Farage. And all three of them represent very different parts of UKIP. You've got kind of like alt-right with Raheem Kassam. You've got I'm not racist, but Middle Englanders with Suzanne Evans and Farage 2.0 and Paul Nuttall.
Before we delve into the specifics of that, should we briefly go over the other two topics that will be
coming
later in the podcast?
I forgot that we hadn't talked about the other two. So also, our great government has decided to let in 70 children who were in the camps at Calais, which is soon to be destroyed by the French. We've also been building the Great Wall of Calais as well, which is... not quite as grand and fancy as the Chinese version, but
Trump's land wall, for that matter.
I don't know. I feel like the Trump wall would probably actually be quite similar.
similar in size.
And in tone as well, and racist kind of like overlay. Although the Chinese, technically, they were trying to keep out the Mongols. Didn't work, though. But we've let in 70 children, most of whom who have... links within the UK, so whether they have extended family or family who are already in the UK before they were taken from Calais. But we've had a bit of a really nasty side of British media, to be completely honest. A lot of these children's photos have been shared on media websites, which goes against press regulations in terms of reporting on minors.
Strictly speaking, there are no press regulations. You mean the code of conduct?
Yes, sir. We've had David Davies, the MP, not the one who's running Brexit, but the other guy called David Davis in the Tory...
There's a lot of Davises in the saga, but there's essentially been a bit of a pushback against people being let into Britain via the Calais jungle, or sorry, children being let into the Calais jungle.
Specifically in that they don't look like children. And then finally... we're going to talk about people going to university and how that's a waste of money, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, given that you've just joined university, it's about the right time to have this discussion between the two of us. And that's based off the back of a report that came back earlier this month from an HR trades body, details of which we will go into at the very end. But roughly speaking, it alleges that there's too many graduates in the UK now, and there isn't really the capacity in the labour market for them to have their alleged skills utilised. So should we roll back to UKIP then, in this slightly contorted format that we have for ourselves?
Yeah, well, you're the one who wanted it to be rambly. the exact words of Jimmy, ladies and gentlemen. I think that it's really, really interesting that, as I was saying, we have the three very distinct factions of UKIP running against one another. I've heard other commentators say stuff along the lines of that this is going to be a way of them being able to kind of heal the party, bring it together, because it is famous for infighting, and see which faction wins out once and for all, whether it is Farage, Middle England, or alt-right. What do you think? Because Suzanne Evans has always been a bit of a media darling. She's been the more palatable kind of polite face of UKIP to Farage's swivelized loony. And the media have always seemed to be quite kind to her. She's got quite a large media presence already. Raheem Kassam isn't really mainstream yet. And Paul Nuttall is probably on a kind of on a similar setting to Suzanne Evans.
I'd say Paul Nuttall, from my understanding, is probably between Suzanne Evans and Raheem Kassam.
Yeah.
Who, given some of the articles that he's published on Breitbart, I think could be fairly termed an extreme figure.
What kind of stuff has he posted on Breitbart?
It's just sort of these... I mean, not all of the articles they post are necessarily unfair, but sort of scaremongering pieces about migration, particularly in relation to the crime and migration. That they were all over the Cologne attacks when they happened. I think that was last Christmas.
Yeah.
And admittedly, the mainstream media was very slow to pick up on that story, and there was a lot of discomfort around reporting that. And it is a legitimate thing to talk about the demographic connections of crime, but I just sort of feel that Breitbart, it very much sits in that kind of Daily Mail niche of jumping on everything that could potentially support their policies and making it sensational and exploding it, rather than having a kind of reasoned debate about what exactly is going on.
A lot of the mainstream media have very much pitted this as Evans versus Nuttall, and have kind of papered over the fact that Kassam is running now.
He is running, but the Nuttall at the moment, if you look at the bookies, odds is the favourite to win, and then Suzanne Evans comes behind him, and then Kassam follows both of those. So it probably does kind of make sense to focus on the main two.
Yeah. Do you think that my analysis is perhaps correct in that it is the UKIP that hate Farage? So, for example, the one MP that they have, Douglas Carswell, is quite publicly not a very big fan of Nigel Farage himself, and is probably going to be backing Suzanne Evans in this. The man who's been groomed for the leadership post-Farage for nearly a decade, Paul Nuttall. Do you think that I've kind of got that analysis right of it's the ones who want to come across as normal versus the personality cults?
That's a slightly slanted way of putting it at the end there.
Me skewing? No, never.
Broadly speaking, yeah, it makes sense to view this as Farage or not Farage, if you see what I mean. Something that Suzanne Evans said in her interview on the Andrew Marr show today was that she wanted to detoxify the party. It actually reminded me a lot of Theresa May's famous nasty party speech when she was chair of the Tories back about a decade ago. So I think Suzanne Evans wants to take away some of those links to the more kind of sensationalist rhetoric around migration, and wants to make the party more palatable to, as you say, middle England, because there has always been a trend in British politics for people, even if they have views that would fit into a far-right party's camp, to feel slightly uncomfortable about voting for a far-right party. It's one of the reasons the BNP never really made significant headway in general elections and that sort of thing.
So this is where I think that they could possibly fall down, because every party says at some point that it's trying to claim the centre ground, and they all have different ideas of what the centre ground is and where it is. But Suzanne Evans has claimed that herself. But she does seem very much like the kind of politician who wants to, who would do well challenging in conservative seats. And pushing UKIP in that particular direction.
However, I don't think it'll necessarily be conservative seats. I would have thought...
You see northern industrial heartlands voting for somebody like Suzanne Evans? I feel like she's too much of a tea and cake, like, shire Tory to me.
I guess, but to some extent, the the UKIP brand, I think, will carry anyway in Northern England. So I also don't know if the kind of Farage successor idea necessarily would carry a great deal better.
But the reason that people like Farage is because he's the kind of guy that millions of working class and middle class men and women would like to have a pint with, because they see somebody, they see people that they know in him. I think that Suzanne Evans is a bit too lofty for that. She seems like the kind of person who'd run the like the PTA or something, but I don't think that she's the kind of person that people would like enjoy hanging around with. And I think that this choice between Evans and Nuttall actually is kind of like a battle for where UKIP pick their fights in the next general election, in the next European election, maybe, who knows, but it defines where they're going to pick their fights. If they pick Evans, then I think that they end up appealing more to people who live in the south, who are Shire Tories, and then if you pick Nuttall, you end up going for the industrial heartlands of the north that have been neglected by Labour, and that are never going to vote Tory because of history.
I think that analysis makes an awful lot of sense, but I would also point out that none of the candidates that are standing have, in my view, the persona to create the kind of cult of personality that Farage was able to create.
Mm-hmm.
But none of them are... describing Farage as charismatic is probably not something that will sit very well with a lot of the listeners here, but...
I mean, he certainly
in a way, he was, right?
You can disagree with him, but he is an incredibly charismatic man, and he was very good at connecting with the people that mattered to him.
I mean, I've seen all of these people on media appearances of various sorts, and I don't think any of them has shown that innate ability to connect with people and be that sort of Farage-esque figure. So,
yeah,
in that sense, maybe the leader is less important, is going to be less important this time around than just the general strategy of UKIP, which, so far as I'm aware, previously, I don't think they've had in great spades.
Apparently they're hemorrhaging the few people who are able to run campaigns for them and are able to be successful in terms of shaping policy and all of that kind of stuff, because the sole purpose for UKIP existing, us leaving the EU, has happened.
I wouldn't say the sole purpose. That was the original reason it was set up. But one of the reasons UKIP was so successful is it managed to change itself into this more broadly reactionary party, you know, an anti-immigration party, and one that actually spoke to the concerns of post-industrial Britain. So,
I think that that's true, but that has now been reclaimed by Theresa May's pivot over the last few months, I think.
Well, if you don't think Suzanne Evans is a very attractive candidate for the sort of the standard UKIP voter that we're thinking of, especially in Northern England, then Theresa May doesn't strike me as necessarily much better.
No, but she's not going for places that are never going to vote Tory, right? She's going for where the UK Independence Party did really well in the south, in like deepest, darkest Middle England, basically, where UKIP comes second to the Tories. That's what she's shored up. She's got a really strong wall there, I think, now, because of the rhetoric that she has over grammar schools, the rhetoric that she has over immigration, and with leaving the EU. I feel like the only place that UKIP can make headways here is by going after Labour seats.
Yes, I'd agree. Yeah,
and so for that reason, I think that they have to choose Paul Nuttall as their next leader, despite the fact that I dislike him immensely. In fact, I don't particularly like any of them, let's be completely fair.
Well, you are part of the Metropolitan Liberal elite now.
So. Yeah, I'm evil. To be honest, fuck it, I'm just going to become Liechtensteinian.
Okay. Isn't Liechtenstein not actually in the EU?
Yeah, but I get to be metropolitan because the whole country is a city.
Yeah.
And then everyone is a part of the metropolitan elite because there's nothing apart from the metropolis.
I mean, it's kind of just a village, so far as I'm aware. There's not that many people living there.
Yeah, but if it's a capital, I think it can claim the whole city status, right? Let's be fair.
It's essentially just Switzerland that just hasn't admitted defeat, though, isn't it? You know. Not hating.
This is why people think that we're part of the alt right. So, shall we? Is there anything else you'd like to say about UKIP? Shall we move on to us having to look at migrant children's teeth?
Yeah, let's do that. Do you want to explain what the teeth reference is pertains to?
The teeth reference is that for some reason David Davis, who is not David Davis. I can't remember which way around it is. There's David Davis and David Davies.
So David Davis is the Brexit secretary, and David Davies is a with an E in that surname.
Is a racist man. And he
he's a backbench MP, isn't he?
Yeah. Well, you can. I'm just defining him in different ways, Jimmy. To be fair,
I was going with job title, but yeah, sorry. Carry on.
Fair. But he suggested that some of the migrant children who were photographed immorally by the press looked older than 18, and then he suggested that we should all send them down to the dentist and make sure that they and get dentists to check their dental records.
Okay.
Because he thinks that you are able to find out how old people are from their teeth.
Can we unpack like a few things in what you just said?
Let's unpack.
Immorally photographed by the press.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
I think that minors, when they are part of... It's common practice, and you'd agree with me, I hope. It's common practice for when there's minors tied up in a significant story for them not to have their images plastered on the front pages of papers. That's correct, right?
That is true, although in this case the story is that they may not actually be children, so...
No, come on, Jimmy. I think that it's completely immoral that they're just assuming, kids who are 14, 15, 16 can sometimes pass for their mid-20s. And funnily enough, when you've like walked the length of Europe, it's probably aged you a couple of years.
Sure, but if that is the story, then...
No,
If your contention... The photo is very, very relevant to the story, so...
No, I'm sorry. Whenever there's a kid involved, I don't think that there's any justification for that whatsoever.
We can agree to disagree on that. So your next point was that the MP in question, David Davies, is racist for proposing dental checks?
I threw the word racist around probably frivolously there, although he clearly doesn't like letting people who need our help into the country, and I'm thoroughly embarrassed by the way that our government has decided to tackle the migration and the refugee crisis from people out of Northern Africa and the Middle East. And he is basically, I'm just very angry at people like him, because it makes me really sad to be British, to be completely honest. That's why I'm calling him racist.
So you're not actually alleging that he's racist?
I mean, I probably deep down he's a little bit racist. But he, the idea that dental records and that looking at somebody's teeth can age them, can tell you their age accurately is just not. There's no science in that.
It depends what you mean by accuracy, right? You won't be able to, from what I've read, you cannot tell the specific age. You can't say this person's 15, but you can get it within the region of about 5 to 6 years was the inference that I took from the pieces I read.
Yeah, but isn't that bloody ridiculous when you're dealing with teenagers who are in the middle of puberty, who are at different stages of puberty and different stages of development? That's not how puberty, like, if there's a 6-year window, if we were determining whether people were over the age of 40 or not, that might seem a little bit more justifiable, but to suggest that this is going to be an accurate way of defining whether somebody is a minor or an adult or not is stupid.
Well, frankly. I don't think, at least my impression is that David Davies wasn't suggesting it was the sole method of doing it, but if it is one among an array of methods, which appears to be what, you know, even some of the critics of his policy say, that if you use several different methods to ascertain the age of someone, then dental checks are not necessarily useless, then that seems kind of reasonable, doesn't it?
No. I don't think so at all, because and this is something that's kind of been thrown around a lot by liberal media, but I'm very happy to be on their side here. When somebody has been through huge amounts of trauma and has had to live in a an unsafe camp and a place that is unsafe for young people, especially young women, and then for them to have to go through stringent checks to check that they're actually an age that we've arbitrarily decided gives them the right to come to this country, I just think that's so... It makes me really, really angry, Jimmy. And it makes me angry, and I'm trying to put it into words, it makes me angry because it implies that people are trying to game the system when they've had to flee their country. That's what makes me really, really fucking depressed in terms of our policy on this particular area.
Well, in pretty much any migration policy, there's going to be people who are trying to game it.
Yes, but I think that when they're children and minors, and when there's even...
The contention is that some adults are pretending to be minors. So
is there a huge difference between somebody who's 18 and somebody who's 17?
No, but there is. If you're creating an asylum policy or a refugee policy, and you decide that you're going to prioritise taking in minors and children over taking in adults, then obviously... In order to be able to, you know, implement that policy effectively, you're going to have some sort of check as to how old people are.
Sure. And if we were thinking about taking a large number of people, like thousands of people, then I would probably understand having a more stringent check system. But the fact that we're taking 70 people, which is nothing, I think that I don't particularly care how accurate it is. And I'm still... I think that we should be taking far more... We should be shouldering the burden of the refugee crisis a lot more than we are. And I bloody hate it, Jimmy.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that there's only 70 people being taken in does imply that in this instance it is kind of a waste of time and this whole debate is a bit useless. But in general, having age checks doesn't seem that inappropriate to my mind.
But so how would you end up doing that to make sure... the idea that was quite jarring for me was the idea that somebody was going to have like molds of their teeth made so that they could be inspected. And and there's something quite animalistic about that.
I mean, I've had... you might have had as well. I've had molds of my teeth made for dental things.
Yeah. But not to make sure that you're able to come into a country that you're seeking asylum in. I think there's something really dehumanising about that, perhaps
is
objectively.
There, though?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it's like I'm being checked like a horse.
Well, you are being checked. That's how migration policies work. I mean, you know, if you've ever had to go through US migration as, you know, even just as a tourist, it's not necessarily the nicest thing. But
have you ever had to be searched in particular areas, Jimmy?
I have not been anally probed. If that's what you're asking.
So I know some people who have been, and it's a bloody horrible experience. It's really easy when you've not had to go through that, I think, as somebody who hasn't had to go through that. It's really easy to be like, oh, yeah, but it's just a check that you have to go through. But when you're being, like, invasively... It is invasive, even if it's like a mold of your teeth being made.
Yeah, sure.
Invasively checked. That's, traumatising and horrific.
It's not horrific.
If there's a background of my future as like a safe human being,
they're coming from France, Jazza. They're not, you know. You're somewhat overstating the case here,
Jimmy. They're coming from France, from an area of France that is a slum, essentially.
Yeah, well, they did choose to go to that area of France, didn't they?
You think that kids had like an active are able to make those kinds of decisions?
Well, who's making the decisions for them then? Are you saying that their parents deliberately sent them to Calais?
I don't know any of the stories of these kids, but there could be any number of reasons why they end up in Calais. They could be there because they think that they have relatives in the UK somewhere, and that's the only way that they can feasibly do it. They could have ended up travelling with somebody else. They could have lost parents somewhere between their country of origin and Europe, and they knew that they were going to Calais for whatever reason. I'd really like us to have a little bit more compassion, to be completely honest.
I don't think it's discompassionate to question why some people are so desperate to get out of France and get into the UK, given that France is a safe country.
But when it's kids, Jimmy.
Sure. When it's kids.
Yeah. Cool. Anyway, next topic, please.
What is the next topic then?
It's your one about universities. More children talk.
Or young adults, as I believe the phrase goes. Earlier this month, as I was saying, there was a study published by the Chartered Institute of Personnel and Development, which is an HR trade association, which, as I said earlier, found that graduate skills are being underutilised in the UK economy, or to put it another way, we are producing too many graduates for our economy to take. I just find this study kind of interesting, especially in the more long-term context of debates around tuition fees and that sort of thing. And I suppose, Jazza, given that you've just decided to take up a master's at Oxford, what's your immediate reaction to this kind of report?
Well, I'm a little bit of an anomaly, and we should probably say, so I went to university, Jimmy didn't, even though we did both go to private school, so we're both posh twats at the end of the day. So I am going and doing a master's not because I want to better my economic prospects, which I think is very different to the majority of people who end up going into higher education. And it wasn't the reason that I did my undergrad either. I wanted to learn Chinese, and so did an undergrad in Chinese and Spanish.
You presumably thought that maybe you didn't, but you know, being able to speak Chinese is a huge asset in the jobs market, isn't it?
It was a secondary thought. Sure. And actually, you know what? It isn't. There's still quite a large number of people who I went to university with and were in my year in my Chinese class have jobs that don't have anything to do with speaking Chinese. I just wanted to be able to speak this really cool language that I'd kind of become obsessed with. And I'm doing a similar thing now with my master's, where I just want to be able to turn what I think is an expertise in a particular field into something that might get published and stuff like that. I want to become an expert in something, rather than, oh, and then I'll be able to work at Facebook, because I did that.
do you think it is fair to say, which is, it seems to be what this report is suggesting and how it's been written up by The Guardian and a few other outlets, that New Labour's policy of getting more and more kids into higher education was maybe not such a good idea?
It didn't seem to be very well planned. I don't agree with the idea of people going into tertiary education just for the sake of going into tertiary education. There needs to be a reason for it. And New Labour worked in a particular way that kind of sometimes inflated their numbers. They turned a load of vocational jobs into university careers. So, for example, nursing used to be something vocational that you went to nursing college to train for, and now it's a university degree. Just as an example of the way that the figures for the number of people going to uni were increased.
I mean, nursing is actually one of the professions picked out by this study in particular. And it did used to be the case that you'd go to nursing college and do a vocational course and then you become a nurse. And I don't know what the percentage is now, but a much higher proportion of nurses are graduates.
All of the graduates after, like, the mid-noughties... All of the people in nursing will be graduates, will have gone to university
That joined it in the mid-noughties, you mean?
Yes, okay. Who started nursing in the mid-noughties, think. Because they just changed what nursing college was. It then became a degree at uni. But I think that it's interesting that we pursued... There is this wonderful
romanticization.
Yeah, that word. Further education as a way of being able to lift yourself up, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. This idea of a meritocracy: if you're smart, then you go to university, that you can do anything, go anywhere, etc., etc. But at the end of the day, if you're qualifying for something, or if you're going to university for a qualification that isn't highly valued, then would it have been better for you to do something other than get drunk for 3 years, which is what a lot of people do at uni?
Let's, I mean, yeah, that's a thing for people to do, I guess. You know, a lot of people say that uni is good, and I can't verify this not having gone, but they say the uni experience, and they don't just mean getting fucked up and having a lot of sex. They also mean, like, the experience of living away from home and, you know, the sort of partial independence that brings, and mm-hmm. the sense of freedom and all of that junk. So there is that argument. I mean, the other side of this study is that in some ways it does advocate for going to university, because one of its findings is that there's been a lot of graduate overspill, so that people who have degrees who would get a job that required a degree are now going to doing it far more likely to do jobs that don't require a degree.
Yeah.
And so everyone's getting shunted down, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, but I think that's terrible for the people who would have probably... So I was about to say that would be terrible for the people who would traditionally fill those roles, but the people who are traditionally filling those roles just ended up going to uni instead, right?
Mm.
And so maybe it's just that stuff like being a policeman or being a teacher's assistant are now graduate roles, and that does kind of reduce the value of the university degree to a certain extent, but then that just means that there's going to be different tiers of university degree. And I think that we already have that in terms of the type of university that you get into, the type of course that you do. For example, if I went to university to do McDonald's studies, which used to be rumored to be a course at Exeter or something, I'm not sure if it was ever actually true, but it's a fun story to tell, to say.
It's a good phrase.
Yeah, it's a good go-to pop culture moment, but like it seems that young people are just being warehoused because we can't find jobs for them, and that
I think it makes a lot of a sense, like status-wise and just in terms of your own self-esteem. If you've left high school and you can't find a job, going to uni is something that, even though it costs you money, there's fewer barriers to entry in some ways. If you've got okay A levels, you can just, rather than fight for a job, you can just go to university, and it's, you know, that you've sort of sorted your life out for the next couple of years, if not beyond that.
Yeah, but I think that there is a fallacy of you going to university and then you getting into a graduate job and then everything being hunky-dory and really, and then you get married and you have 2.5 kids and all of that bullshit. That doesn't necessarily happen. And at the end of the day, you're either going to have to get lucky or graft a huge amount to be able to be successful, and to be able to not end up being a pencil pusher in somebody's office somewhere. And there is this kind of fallacy, I think, of university opening a load of doors for you automatically just by the virtue of being university. And I think that is, especially now going to Oxford a couple of days a week, you kind of realize that a lot of the value is knowing the people that you know there, but you have to like work hard, hustle, find the right internships, like do additional qualifications outside of your degree and all of that kind of stuff if you actually want to make it. And I think that is partially a problem with the assumption of university as like the default for young people in terms of their options once they finish secondary school. But yeah, what do you think? Are you slightly smug about this whole thing, is you never went to uni?
Probably. I mean, I'm quite a smug bastard anyway, so it maybe doesn't show off that much. But
you have your moments.
I'm a little bit, and this is one of the reasons that I didn't go to university, aside from just disliking school. I'm a little bit sceptical about what a non-vocational type degree, so I'm not including studying to be a doctor or studying to be an engineer in this, but if you do something usually on the liberal arts side, I'm not entirely sure what it is in terms of skills that you come away with. You obviously spend a lot of time analysing various different you know, types of information and that sort of thing. And I'm sure on some level that does train you up a little bit for the needs of, you know, the information economy and the service sector and all of that stuff. But I have a slight suspicion, and this report has somewhat confirmed it, although not completely, that university is largely just a filing system to see, like, how long you can survive in the education system, and then you get sent out, you're like, okay, well, you're this smart, but you haven't actually learnt a great deal more. They've just sort of tested you for being that smart, if you see what I'm saying.
No, I don't. What do you mean in terms of, like, figuring out how smart you are?
So
do you mean by, like, the grade that you get at the end of it, or, well, like, the skills? Because you do end up seeing, especially now that we have ridiculously huge amounts of money being spent on people's undergraduate degrees. It's now $9,000 a year.
I mean, that money was spent before. It was just spent by the government or the taxpayer.
Yeah. But now it's on personal people's debt, which is different.
It's not real debt, though, so...
Let's not have this conversation. There's now, I've definitely noticed in the last few years more of a push for
real life
skills.
Right, okay.
Being able to, like, summarize text, being able to work in teams, being able to project manage and all of that kind of stuff. And those are all things that when you're applying for jobs, they're really keen for you to kind of push as the skills that you got out of uni rather than just going down to the student union every Thursday.
So when you say there's been a push for it, do you mean from the student side or from the employer's side or what?
From both, I think, but definitely with students. I certainly noticed that with my cousins who are paying the higher amount of student fees than myself and my brother did. They are way much more on it in terms of what they want out of the degree and in terms of how they're going to get to where they want to go, because they're spending a shit ton of money on it. And that to us, so I think that the increased fees,
that's a positive, right?
I think that the increased fees have actually been good in that, because they've made people actually consider, what do I actually want out of this, rather than, oh, like, I just need to go to uni because that's what everybody tells me to do. People go to uni now, I think, and have to actually think about it because they're in so much debt at the end of it. And I am also skeptical about just having an arbitrary number of people going to university being a good thing.
So how should it be set then if it's not by an arbitrary number, as you put it?
I mean, so how does it get decided now?
Well, the New Labour had an aim.
Had a 50% aim.
The 50%
and they never
aim.
Actually got there. And it's dipped slightly below that now. I think are we in the mid-40s now?
I don't know, possibly. That sounds reasonable.
I don't think there necessarily should be an aim. There should be, I think that this is something where the market should be able to do its thing.
Possibly, although... I guess it sort of plays into a wider conversation as to how the government directs education in order to get people to have the right skills, because on an individual level, it's very difficult for just a random parent to be able to know what skills their children are going to need 20 years down the line when they're first feeding them into the education system.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, but you're generally in agreement that we... should have less people going to university then?
Maybe. I actually lied, so I've just gotten onto a full fact. and in 2015, 31% of 18-year-olds in England were accepted into a university place.
That's quite a lot lower than 50%.
It is quite a lot lower than 50%. But then, so I think that one of the problems that we have is... lots of people say, oh, we should send fewer people to university, send more of them to vocational courses.
That is, like, a very popular line.
Like accounting, like plumbing, like blah, X, Y, Z, P, Q, N, Y. The problem is that in our society, vocational qualifications are still not seen as good as university degrees, and for as long as that is maintained, as long as that stereotype exists, we're still going to see more people going to university because of the amount of money that you're able to earn by going to uni. And it still does more than pay for itself, even with the increased fees. And so that we require a culture change. Either that, or we just turn all vocational things into university degrees and we get rid of, we challenge that stigma. And accept that a university degree is going to become devalued because of it.
I suppose, but I mean that seems like an almost impossible process, given the tendency for, you know, people, higher class people, to go into more intellectual, abstract thinking type jobs, and then the tendency for lower class people to go in more into manual jobs. It just seems destined for it to be stratified in that way.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I've got to go now, Jimmy.
You've got to go. Okay.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell people where to find you on Twitter so they can
tell
you to be quiet more often?
Yeah. And I agree, the gay guy needs to shut up more. And we're clearly a wing of the alt right now. But I am on Twitter at JazzerJohn, and I'm on YouTube /rhymingwithoranges.
And you can find me at JDE Nichols, and you can tweet the podcast more generally at Right Dishonor. Should we wrap
up there? And tell us that we don't know anything about nothing. Because we don't, really.
That'll probably happen now.
I know, right? Fun. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.